Okay, good morning and welcome back to everyone after the longer break. Trust everyone had a good Yontif. Just as a housekeeping announcement, there's some chairs here. Here we are. Okay, right. We're here. It's a little stuffy in here, but we just have put on the air conditioning. However, that means that it could get cold. In which case, we'll put it off in the middle. So don't worry. Okay, as I said, I think some chairs at the back. Still some chairs here. As I said, welcome to term four. This is the last. Here we are already. This is the last term of 2012. Just for a bit of future planning, just to remind everyone, this is a little bit of a shorter term, as for good reasons, as I'm going to be traveling. Thank God, I'm traveling overseas for my son's wedding in about 5 weeks. Thank you very much. So this series, therefore, goes. The Thursday series goes till the 15th of November. I think it's 5 weeks we have. However, later on in the year, on the 25th of December, I will be back. Before that, we'll have our yearly summer learning experience, so please watch the emails for all the information. Okay, so this series is called Your Worth, 6 Ways to Discover and Nurture Your Intrinsic Value. And today we're going to spend a little bit of time on an introduction, but before I do that, let me just give an introduction to the introduction. When we first started these Thursday morning sessions, I don't know how many years ago it was, but it was a number of years ago. I remember very clearly the first one we did actually was on stress. I think I was particularly stressed out at the time or something about it. So I decided to do it. We've done it again since, by the way. We'll do it again, don't worry. And towards the end of the session on stress, we talked about the link actually between stress and self-esteem. And talked about that very often. Stresses come from external sources, but also stress comes from internal sources, that we devalue ourselves and we judge ourselves negatively and feel very threatened, and that becomes the source of many, many areas of stress. And we started to talk a little bit about self-esteem. So the next session after that, we actually did a whole series on self-esteem, and that was, I think, very, very early on. And we developed the idea, and at that time I was reading a lot of the works of Rabbi Dr. Twersky, who talks a lot about self-esteem. In fact, he writes often that he was once asked, he's an older man today, and he was once asked, how did he manage to write so many books? He's written over 40 books, and to which he responded, and he said, he actually hasn't written 40 books, he's written one book 40 different ways, because he really believes that self-esteem and healthy self-esteem is the source of everything, and that's why in all his books it sort of comes through. And over the years, as you know, this has popped up here and there. We talk about it often, and we link the perception we have of ourselves to many of the topics we've been talking about and discussing. But I thought it would be important to revisit some of those ideas in a more structured way, and we'll talk about some new concepts and revisit some of the older concepts. Those of you who are here right from the beginning, this might be a little bit of revision, but hopefully some new concepts as well. But as we always talk about, these ideas can never really finish. These ideas are things we have to revisit all the time, because they're not something we learn and apply and it's done, it's completed. These are things which, of course, lifelong missions, and they need to be revisited all the time and thought about all the time, internalized all the time, reflected upon all the time, in order for them to really have an effect. It's not something you do and you succeed at, something you work on all the time. So talking about your worth and discovering and nurturing our intrinsic value, this is really about this concept of having a healthy perception about ourselves and trying to understand what that means and how we achieve that. So today, as an introduction, what I want to try and do is achieve three things. First thing is to define what that means. What is a healthy self-esteem? What does that actually mean? Secondly, just to mention and talk a little bit about how that affects everything that we do. It affects our relationships, it affects how we operate, it affects stress, it affects our ability not to become angry. It affects almost everything in character and personal development. Self-esteem and the way we view ourselves really always comes in and always affects how it always works. And we'll talk a little bit about that today, more about that in coming weeks, of course. And the third thing is to touch upon this idea that really this whole concept of developing what we call a positive self-image or a healthy self-esteem is really actually, as we'll discover today and develop today, central to Jewish belief. In fact, it's made much easier in Jewish thinking. Once we understand the perspective, the Jewish perspective on the whole concept of the relationship between a human being and God, and the way a human being was created and designed in the divine image, and how it all happened, we'll understand that this idea of understanding our intrinsic worth or having a healthy self-perception is actually critical to Jewish thinking and made much easier by Jewish thinking. So let's just begin with a very simple definition, because there's different ways of talking about self-esteem, and we'll talk about that soon. But I want to base myself and what we're going to develop over the next few weeks on this very simple definition. Understanding our intrinsic worth or having a positive self-esteem means, in this context, the belief and the acknowledgement that every single person, and every single person means including ourselves, has an intrinsic value, number one. And that secondly, every single person has what we call competencies. We are all competent at something. We all have strengths and we're all good at something. Now, we'll translate that in a few minutes, but that's the definition. And on a very basic level, come in, this is the chair right here. And on a very basic level, as I said, with Jewish thinking, that becomes a very easy thing to understand. Because one of the very first things, you know, we've just had Simchat Torah. And on Simchat Torah, we completed the reading of the Torah scroll and we began it once again. We began from Bereshit, the beginning of creation, Genesis. And one of the things it talks about in Genesis is that the human being was created Betzelem Elohim, in the image of God. In other words, there's a divine imprint upon every single human being. Now, on a very simple level, it's not difficult to understand that God doesn't make junk. Right? This is not a made in China sort of imitation, cheap labor sort of. Right? If it's God's design, and not only is it God's design, but it's in the image of God, it follows logically, therefore, that intrinsically the creation of the human being is a good thing. And every human being possesses that imprint and that divine value. One of the things that always disturbs me in other thinkings, I just think it's incredibly morbid and depressing, the notion that a person is born in sin. Now, it's very, very important and critical to understand that that's completely foreign to Jewish thought. In Jewish thinking, a person is never born in sin. A person is born in purity. There's a few things in the Torah, for example, that are referred to as holy, and one of them is sexuality. If it's done correctly and if it's done in particular context, etc. Because the sexual union between man and woman giving birth to a child is considered that there are something of purity and holiness, not something in sin. Right? And it goes back to the creation of the very first human being created in the image of God. So when we talk about a person having an intrinsic value, that's easy to understand once we look at it from a Jewish perspective. And in terms of the second part of the definition, the concept of competencies, here once again becomes much easier when we understand the Jewish perspective, because once again, one of the fundamental beliefs in creation is that creation has a purpose. We didn't just happen. It didn't just happen by mistake. It's not a random occurrence. But God created the world. It's one of the fundamentals of Jewish faith. 6 days of creation, and then on Shabbat He rested, which is why we have Shabbat. And why did He create the world? Obviously for a purpose, for a reason. And therefore, if He created the world for a purpose, and that purpose was then expressed and revealed and channeled through the human being, as we read about in Genesis, because the Talmud tells us that one of the reasons that the human being was created last, God created everything else before the human being, was because everything was there as a preparation for the human being to come and fix and elevate and give meaning and purpose to. And therefore, if the human being is created in the image of God, and creation has a purpose, And that purpose is realized and achieved through the human being. Therefore, every single human being has a contribution to make. So that's a very simple but profound idea. That we need to understand that every person has that intrinsic value and every person has a contribution to make to the purpose of the world. I think I told you the story once. Rabbi Manus Friedman tells the story of, he was once making some hospital rounds and he came across a teenager that was suicidal and in a very, very deep depression. And everyone had come, and chaplains and social workers, and everyone had come and tried their best with this guy, and nothing was moving him. So they asked Rabbi Friedman if he would maybe try. He's a very well-renowned speaker, a good thinker. So he comes in, and as soon as he comes in, a teenager, I think it was a boy, a young teenage boy, pulled the blankets off his eyes and says, "I'm not interested in you." So he says, "Why not?" So from under his blanket, he says, "Because I know what you're going to tell me. You're going to come and tell me what they all told me. God loves me. God this, God that. God doesn't love me." So in order to catch his attention, Rabbi Friedman tells him, "No, God doesn't love you." Oh, so now he finally found someone that agreed with him. So he takes off the cover from over his eyes and he said, "Oh, really? What do you mean God doesn't love me?" You know, now he's going to challenge him the other way around. He said, no, right now God doesn't love you because you're not really doing very well. But God needs you. It's a big difference. You need to love yourself because you need to understand that God needs you, but God needs every single person. And that's why I say that even when we start off with a very simple and basic definition of self-esteem and positive self-image and understanding our worth, from a Jewish perspective, it becomes much easier to understand if we create that as a frame of reference. But the problem is this, and the problem is that in our modern sort of Western way of thinking, often we get introduced to terminology that we kind of misunderstand or maybe even abuse that terminology. And therefore, it's very important to understand what this terminology means. What does it mean that every person has intrinsic worth? What does it mean that every person has competencies? And I'm sharing this with you because I read a fascinating article. I read it a few years ago, but I remembered it, so I Googled it, and it came up, thank God, in a few seconds. It was an article by Dennis Prager. Now, Dennis Prager, I'm sure, is well known to many of you. A great advocate for Jewish issues, as well as a very famous American talkback radio host, and a great writer. He writes a weekly article. He's on the right, and very, very strongly so. And he has great views, and I'm quite a fan of his writing. And I remember this article I wrote, and I thought, oh man, you got it wrong completely this time. Because he wrote an article about self-esteem. I'm going to share bits with you. And it's very simple to understand why he made that, what I believe strongly is a fundamental mistake. So listen to what he writes. I'll just read some excerpts to you so you understand where I'm going. He says, "By now, most people, with the exception of many psychotherapists, recognize that the self-esteem movement officially launched in California in 1986 has been at best silly and at worst detrimental to society, despite whatever small benefit it may have had to some individuals." All right, so he's against the self-esteem movement. Why? He says, "This belief that increasing self-esteem will increase goodness in society spread through the rest of America like a proverbial wildfire. It turns out, however, that the premise was entirely misguided. There is no correlation between goodness and high self-esteem, but there is a correlation between criminality and high self-esteem." Okay? This is not what you're going to be hearing from me in the next few weeks, but I wanted to share with you what he says. Okay? He says that some professor, and he quotes a whole long name, he has revealed that in a lifetime of study of violent criminals, the one characteristic nearly all the criminals have is high self-esteem. Which I don't believe is true. Yes, people with high self-esteem are the ones most prone to violence. Now that seems very scary, right? So I'm thinking, where is he going? Like, where did he get this from? And as I'm reading, I suddenly realized where he went wrong. And he says the following. Listen to this. This is incredible. He said, "In the 1960s and 70s, that era ushered in what I refer to as the age of feelings. And one of the most enduring feelings-based notions that came out of the era that it was critically important that children feel good about themselves. High self-esteem, it was decided, should be imparted to children no matter how undeserving, wherever possible." Now that's where he's going wrong. "This is why," listen to what he says, "boys on losing teams are given trophies. Why more and more high schools have ceased naming a valedictorian, lest the other graduates feel bad about themselves. Why some states have abolished winning and losing in children's soccer games." And then he says, "A friend of mine provided me with a perfect illustration. at a little league baseball game. I'm not sure what that is. Maybe you know some, but anyways, it's some American thing. He saw a pitch thrown a few feet above the batter's head. Needless to say, the batter didn't swing, right? So the ball went over, but he wasn't able to get it. But to my friend's amazement, he heard the batter's father and coach yell out, "Good eye." I says, for those who don't know baseball, it does not take a good eye not to swing a ball at a ball thrown over one's head. It takes a functioning eye. Right? It's not, you don't have a good eye, it's not a talent to miss a ball that went over. So as soon as I saw him describe self-esteem that way, I understood that what he's done, and as I said, I'm a big fan of his writing normally, but what he's done is he's completely misunderstood what self-esteem is. Not he's misunderstood, but in the confusion of Western terminology, in many, many areas, and very often, the term self-esteem has been misunderstood and has been abused. And when it's misunderstood and abused, it's actually destructive and not constructive. And that's why I'm spending a few minutes so we understand what this means. What does it mean to feel good? What does it mean to have a positive self-image? Right? And what I mean by that is that intrinsic value doesn't mean, let me tell you what doesn't mean first of all. It doesn't mean that you are all good and you have no faults. It doesn't mean that. And if we teach children that, that's terrible. It doesn't mean that you have a good eye when you miss a ball. No, it doesn't mean that at all. It certainly doesn't mean an inflated ego. See, this is the problem. Often, to build self-esteem, particularly in children, what people do is instead of building self-esteem in the proper way, understanding really what it is, they actually inflate a negative ego, which is the complete opposite to self-esteem, and very detrimental and very destructive. See, also, we talk about competencies, that every single person has a competency. It doesn't mean that every person is talented. Some people are not that talented, but it doesn't matter. That's just reality. Some people have a cluster of talent. Some people are extremely artistic and musical and good at mathematics and good at studying and everything. And some people just are average, ordinary people. That's the reality. Right? But nevertheless, they are no less than the people with talents. And nevertheless, they have a very strong set of competencies. Their competency just doesn't happen to be in the area of music and art or mathematics, but it has there's a very, very strong sense of competencies. If competencies means, as we said before, a contribution to make to fulfilling the purpose and meaning of creation. In fact, they might have stronger competencies than the talented person. Competencies has nothing to do with talent. And it doesn't matter not to have a talent. And if a little kid is playing baseball and he keeps missing the ball, it doesn't matter. He's right. It's extremely detrimental and silly to praise them and compliment them on their great baseball skills that simply don't exist. And it doesn't matter if it doesn't exist. I mean, gosh, if I tried for the next 60 years to learn to play baseball, it wouldn't help because I wouldn't be able to do it. I'm not even trying.
Recently in the magazine, I just saw a big article and they're saying praise is now out. You have to define what it is that you're... Just say, yes, you're great.
You've got to
say what you did.
Sure. Praise is out because praise was done wrongly.
Yes,
right?
Praise is done wrongly.
And by the way, that's a common syndrome of our society. That's what I call the pendulum effect. Every time something new comes in, people implement it to its extreme. Normally anything to its extreme is then abused and misunderstood and done wrongly. Then, of course, it doesn't work. Well, it doesn't work because you used it wrongly. And then we swing it all the way back again, right? And then in 20 years, they'll say, oh no, we've killed the society. Let's go back to praise, right? So then what is self-esteem? And if it's not these things, so what is it? What do I mean when we talk about intrinsic value? What do we mean when we talk about understanding that every person has competencies from a Jewish perspective? So let me share with you the following thought, and bear with me, we'll go on a bit of a journey. One of the most critical values in Jewish thinking is the negation of ego. We've talked about this many times. Not to have an ego. The Talmud talks about arrogance or ego and says that there's one thing that God cannot tolerate, and that is arrogance. God said, I'm prepared to tolerate and accept everything. I can accept impurity. I can coexist with someone that has transgressed, that has done the wrong thing, that has even been immoral. I can do lots of things, but God says, there's one thing I have difficulty, so to speak, tolerating and accepting is arrogance and ego. Which, of course, the flip side of that is that one of the most admirable and admired virtues in Jewish thinking is humility. Okay. Now, in Hasidic thought, in the early days of Hasidic philosophy, this concept was then extended a bit and talked about with a different terminology, and I'm going to share with you this terminology because it's important to understand the idea of bittul. Okay. Bittul means nullification. On the surface, it appears to mean that bittul means like self-negation. Right? There was this tremendous discussion and philosophy and intense study that all surrounded around the concept of not focusing on the I, or as they called it in Yiddish, not focusing on the ich. Right? In Yiddish, ich means I. Right? There was like an allergy to people who would talk like ich zog, I say, or ich halt, or I hold. When someone would use the word I too often, it was considered arrogant, right? Like in English, people say that, you know, people use the word I too often, they say they're an eye specialist, right? So they tell a story, for example, just to show you how much this was emphasized. Okay. There was the disciple of the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov was the founder of the Hasidic movement. His disciple was the Magid of Mezrich, he was called, the Dov Ber of Mezrich. He was the successor, and he had many, many, many great students. One of the students, one of the oldest students, who had already graduated in the time of the story and sort of moved on to a different town, was a great tzaddik by the name of Rav Aaron of Karlin. And he was a senior student. He was called Rav Aaron HaGadol, Rav Aaron the Great. And he had moved on. He was a very, very great tzaddik, a righteous, saintly person. And he had moved on. He was living, I think, in the town of Karlin or in a different town at the time. And this story happens where there was a younger student who had spent some time studying with the Magid of Mezrich and felt that he had got what he needed to get. He had absorbed the teachings of the Magid of Mezrich and decided to travel home. As he's traveling home, he passes by the town where his senior colleague and his old-time friend, Reb Aaron of Karlin, was living. So he figures, you know what, I'm going to stop at his house and I'm going to say hello. And it was late at night, but he knew that Reb Aaron was probably up anyway and he was studying, which was true. So he comes and he sees there's a light in the study. The whole town is, it was winter, it was cold, and the whole town is quiet. But Reb Aaron is studying and he's very absorbed and immersed in his study. He's sort of lost in a different reality, a different world. And he's sure that he won't mind that if he disturbs him and he knocks on his door and he says hello. So he knocks on the door, knocks loudly, and Rav Aaron looks up from his Talmud page or whatever he was studying and he says, Veridos, who's there? To which the student replied, Ich, me. So Rav Aaron ignored him. And he kept learning. God's a bit perplexed. Waits a few minutes, he's getting a bit cold, he's a little hungry, knocks on the door, once again, Rav Aaron, who was known for his love of other Jews, love of people, hospitality, can't understand why he won't open the door, knocks on the door again, Rav Aaron says, Veridos, who is there? Student says, Ich, I'm there. And he ignores him. Anyway, he doesn't know what to do, he waits, he says, okay, I'll try a third time. So after a while, and by this time he was pretty cold and a little bit tired and hungry, he gives a very, very loud knock on the door, and finally, Rav Aaron comes to the door. Oh, Rav Aaron says, Shalom Aleichem, welcome, come in, how are you? It's a good time, long time no see, etc. They get talking. And after a while, the student says, I've forgotten the student's name, but the student said to Rav Aaron, just, what's the story? Like, why did you open the door? To which Rav Aaron says, he says, tell me, what are you doing now? He says, well, I'm finished with the Mezritcha Magid, and I'm on the way home. He says, what do you mean you're finished? He says, well, I've learned, and hopefully I've absorbed his teachings. I've internalized them. I now know how to live my life based on his inspiration. I'm on the way home. He says, I don't think you've learned anything. He says, what do you mean? He says, how could it be that when I asked who's there, you said, if? What kind of terminology is that? I see from your answer that you're still focused on yourself. You went to study by the Magid for so many years, but you're still there with your own if. You're still focused on me, on I. I think you need to go back. And the student listened. He turned around and he went back to the Magid of Mezrich. So you should work on this trait of getting rid of the if. He says, I ignored you because how can a person say if? There's no I. What does that mean? Why was it so important? What was he trying to t- telling. So let's go to a different story. In the times of the Talmud, one of the greatest sages of the Talmud was known as Hillel, right? Some of you might be familiar, we have often halachic disputes between the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai. Hillel and Shammai. Hillel was renowned. He was a great, great sage. He was renowned for his patience. And he was renowned for his humility. And he was renowned for his ability never to lose his temper, never to get angry. Right? This was Hillel. Hillel was known. He was just the most patient, kind, refined, humble human being. So there was once a discussion between a Jew and his non-Jewish neighbor. The non-Jewish neighbor says to him, I heard you guys have a big rabbi called Hillel that never gets angry. He says, yeah, absolutely, proudly. No, well, not that. He says, well, I bet you I can make him angry. I can make him angry. He says, no, I'm telling you, never make him angry. So they bet. They took a bet for 400 zuz, the Talmud tells us. 400 zuz, a lot of money. And this guy was so confident he's going to make him angry, he says, no problem, I'll take the bet and I'm going. So he went to his house and he found out when, it's a crazy story, he found out when is the time, you know, in olden times to take a bath was a big deal, right? You had to boil up the water. It was like a big, big, big process and it was normally done, particularly, not so often, but Erev Shabbat on Friday, that was, you know, when everyone's rushing, that was the time people would prepare for Shabbat. They boil up water, take a bath. So this guy finds out when is it that Hillel takes a bath. When's his bath time? A Friday afternoon, right? That's the worst time to disturb someone. And he comes to his house and he screams. He says, Hillel, Hillel, where's Hillel? Does Hillel live here? First of all, which was disrespectful, didn't even say, Rabbi Hillel. Anyway, a few minutes later, Hillel comes in a robe, comes out and says, yes, my son, what's the problem? Do you have something bothering you? Do you need a question? Can I answer you? To which he says, yes, I have a very, very important question. He says, what's the question? He says, why do the Tadmors, I don't know who Tadmors are, but it's some sort of nation, have sore eyes? Some completely irrelevant, ridiculous question. So Hillel says, you know, that's actually a very good question. And I'll tell you, he says, because they live near the desert and sand gets into their eyes and makes them sore, whatever, okay. Oh, okay, the guy failed. So he says, don't worry, he'll lose his patience. He comes back, waits for him to make sure he gets back into the bath, comes back 10 minutes later, same thing, screams, Hillel, Hillel, comes out. And he says, a different nation or something, the Babylonians or something, why do they have flat feet? He says, yeah, it's an important question. And he explains to them why that particular nation, that particular community normally have flat feet. Anyway, he goes away and he's in trouble, right? He's going to lose 400 zuz. He doesn't know what to do. So he comes back and he says, listen, he's going to make him. He's going to be very, very disrespectful. He's going to try a different tact. He become more aggressive, right? So again, he comes back and he screams, Hillel, Hillel, come out, etc. Hillel comes out, wrapped in a robe. And then he says to him, tell me, are you the one who they call Hillel, the Prince of Israel? Hillel says, yeah, that's what they call me. I guess that must be me. He says, well then, I wish there will be never, ever another person like you in the nation of Israel. So Hillel gets a bit of a fright and he says, my son, why do you say that? He says, because of you, the reason is because of you, I've lost 400 zuz. He says, I bet for 400 zuz that I would make you angry. And no matter how long I've tried, I didn't succeed. To which Hillel responded and he said, in a very, very calm way, he said, it's better that you should lose 400 zuz and that I should never become angry because anger is such a terrible thing. This is part one of the story. A story that shows in the extreme the humility of Hillel. Hillel was not focused on himself. He wasn't focused on his self-interest. He was so humble that even though he was being disturbed, he was being insulted, he was fine with it. He had no problem. He was able to stay calm. He was able never to lose his temper. He was able to treat the other person with respect. The ultimate, the epitome of that concept I talked about before of what appears to be self-negation and taking away the focus on the ich. He had what we call total bittul. He had that self-nullification, the self-negation to the nth degree. Yet, the same Hillel, made the most amazing, what appears to be the most arrogant statement ever. When was that statement made? The Talmud, we've just come from the festival of Sukkot, right? And the festival of Sukkot, we have a story in the Talmud that in the times of the temple, there was this great celebration that would take place every night in the temple. It was in preparation to drawing water, which they would then pour on the Mizbeach and the altar. A very festive time, and the Talmud says it was the most amazing thing. In fact, the Talmud says that whoever never saw that type of celebration never really truly experienced joy, right? That's how amazing it was. And what used to happen is every night they would gather, for the 7 nights of Sukkot, they would gather in the temple, and the whole night they would play instruments, and if it wasn't Shabbat or whatever, they would play instruments and they would dance. And it says the great sages themselves would do juggling acts and acrobatics and all kinds of amazing things. They would sing songs and praises for God the entire night until dawn. And dawn would happen, then they would go out and they would draw the water and come back and do the service of the day. And the Talmud quotes about different songs that various sages would sing. And it quotes the words, the lyrics of those songs. And one of them was a song that Hillel would sing. The same Hillel. And the lyrics of the song that Hillel would say was, listen to this phrase. He would say, "Im ani kan hakol kan." If I am here, everyone's here. Doesn't sound like a humble guy, right? If I am here, everyone's here. That's the lyrics Hillel would say. So the question is, what's going on here? This is a humble person. This is the person that can never get angry. This is the person that some nudnik can come on a Friday afternoon and insult him and nag him and drive him crazy and distract him from his preparations to Shabbat and his bath time, etc., etc. And he gets up and he says, "Im ani kan hakol kan." If I am here, everyone is here. But these two stories put together give us a little bit of understanding to what this whole concept is about. When we talk about bittul, when we talk about humility, it doesn't mean that a person has a feeling of "I am nothing." That's not a healthy feeling at all. It doesn't mean that a person has a feeling of "I have no identity. I hate myself. I'm a shmata. I'm nothing. I'm a rag." That's not bittul. That's not humility. That's false humility. What humility in the Jewish perspective really means, and when I explain to you what it means, you'll see that humility is synonymous with self-esteem. Not just incompatible or doesn't go, or contradictory. It's actually, it goes hand in hand. What humility means is that I have no independent identity. What that means is, true humility in the Jewish sense means that I didn't create myself. I am not superior to anyone else because, not because I'm nothing, but because I'm nothing in the sense I don't have an independent ich. I don't have independent I. Why? Because, going back to what I said in the very beginning, I was created, divinely created by God. And therefore, I am really part of a greater reality. Right? This needs to be understood carefully. I am nothing, not because I don't exist. If I didn't exist, then I'm useless. I'm redundant. I am nothing because I am part of something far greater. Whoever I am, the whole of myself is not mine. The whole of myself was made and created and designed by a much greater power. The power of God, the divine spark. What does that mean? Therefore, what's the outcome of that? The outcome of that is that I'm actually greater than I thought I was. You see, if everything about me is me, every human being, every creation is very, very finite. The definition of a creation in this world is that it's very finite and very fragile and very mortal and very limited. But when I understand that I'm nothing because I'm actually part of a greater reality, that doesn't make me smaller, it makes me bigger. It makes me far greater. It makes me infinite. But it makes me part of a huge reality that everyone else is part of also. And it makes me understand that the whole of me has infinite potential because the whole of me was created by an infinite God. And that God, that infinite God, created everything about me. My strengths and my weaknesses and my core foundation at the very essence of myself. And therefore, when I understand that I am nothing because I'm part of something a lot greater, I am nothing as an independent, as a separate me, but I'm part of a much greater reality, and I don't feel superior to anyone else, I acknowledge that I might have lots of talents. I might have lots of competencies. I might have lots of strengths. And everyone has strengths. And that's part of developing a good self-perception, is to identify and understand those strengths. And we're going to talk about it over the next few weeks. But they're not mine. Because I have strength doesn't make me better than you. Because I can do something maybe that you can't do doesn't make me a superior human being. Because I can't do something that you can do doesn't make me an inferior human being. Because we both have the same imprint. We're both made by the same God. We're both part of the same reality, who decided to create everyone differently. Understanding that I was created... Is this clear?
Yeah. Yeah.
Understanding that I was created in the image of God means that I understand that at the very basic essence of my being, I have an intrinsic purity that can never be damaged. Because there's a divine spark that is at the foundation. And we'll talk about this more next week. It's at the foundation of every human being. It also means that I have a set of strengths and a set of weaknesses, and that's fine. It's fine. I need to work on the strengths, I need to work on the weaknesses, I need to nurture the strengths, I have to take responsibility for the weaknesses, but I'm not defined by them. It doesn't make me a better person, it doesn't make me a worse person. It makes me who I am. Bittul, humility means, the definition of humility means that I'm not superior to another person. And why am I not superior to another person? Because I am very comfortable who I am. Once I've realized that I'm part of this greater reality, that's a fantastic piece of news. But so are you part of that greater reality. And therefore, I'm not superior to you, you're not superior to me. That's what humility means. It also means I don't have to defend my identity, because it's not such a fragile, weak, limited, finite, mortal identity. It's something that's much greater and part of a much greater reality. But it also means that I know who I am, and I'm comfortable with that. I know who I am means I know my strengths and I know my weaknesses. According to the Torah, the most humble human being that ever lived was Moses. It says it in the Chumash. That Moses was the Anav Ma'od. He was the most humble person of all human beings. And in Jewish belief, that means, because the Torah is eternal, that means that the Torah foresaw, so to speak, that there would never be a humble person like Moses. He is the epitome of humility. Did Moses not know that he was the greatest prophet? He did. Because the same Torah that God dictated to him to write that he was the most humble human being, also God dictated to him to write that he was the greatest prophet. We just read it on Simchat Torah. Did Moses not know he was a great leader? Did Moses think he was a nothing? Was he not assertive? Was he not confident? Did he not take 600, 3 million Jews out of Egypt? Did he not give us the Torah? Did he not lead us through the desert for 40 years? So what does it mean he was humble? He was humble because after doing all of that, he didn't think he was any superior to any one of us. That's humility. Now let's go back to Hillel. Hillel was the most humble of human beings. That doesn't mean he didn't know his greatness. That didn't mean he didn't understand his strengths. But he had the sense that with all his strength and all his greatness, him and the nudnik that came to nag him on Friday afternoon was the same. He chose. By the way, he didn't get angry. He didn't come out and attend to him because he felt compelled to. See, sometimes we respond to people, and we'll talk about this, is a very, very important fine line to understand. He didn't say yes to the person because he felt he had to, and then got agitated afterwards. He made the choice to. Because he made the choice that it's not a problem for him to interrupt himself and to talk to that guy. He made a choice not to get angry. Why? Because Hillel was the true essence of humility. He was completely understood where he came from. He was completely comfortable with himself. And when a person is comfortable with oneself, when a person accepts themselves, when a person really understands that they have no independent, fragile, finite identity that they have to fight to defend, but they're part of a greater reality, and therefore they learn to accept every part of themselves and work with themselves and take responsibility for themselves, and understand their true worth and intrinsic value, then you can make space for other people. Then you're not threatened, and then you can make other people part of who you are. And that's why Hillel, the same Hillel, said, "Im ani kan hakol kan." If I am here, everyone's here. Meaning not arrogance, God forbid. What Hillel was saying is that because I've learned to accept who I am, because I understand who I am, because I don't feel superior to anyone else, because I'm fully comfortable with myself, with the understanding that that does not make me superior to any human being, that's why Hakol Kan, that's why everyone is part of my reality as well. There was the story of a great Rebbe called the Tzemach Tzedek, where a disciple of his came to him and complained. He said, "Rabbi, I've got a problem. Every time I go to shul, everyone steps on me." Meaning figuratively, everyone steps on me. He said in Yiddish, "Metet of me." So the Tzemach Tzedek used the same imagery and he said to him, "Well, who told you to spread yourself over the whole shul?" You wouldn't spread yourself everywhere. No one would step on you. What does that mean? You see, self-esteem doesn't mean that you believe that you're better than you are. Self-esteem doesn't mean arrogance. Self-esteem doesn't mean talented. Self-esteem doesn't mean overconfident. You should understand that there are people who you know, I'm sure, or people who we all know, that appear to be overly confident. There are people we know who are incredibly talented, and talented because they've achieved wonderful things in their field, or whatever the case is, that have the most shocking self-esteem. Which is why so many other areas of their life sometimes is so messed up. The person who's a very, very talented medical expert and who buries himself in his work and never comes home and he's discovering and helping the world and yet has terrible relationships. Why? Such a talented person. Because the person might be talented and might be confident, but they have a terrible self-image. And because they have a terrible self-image, they have to fight to defend that image. So what do? They only live in areas where they know they can succeed. And they are shocking in environments or areas where they feel threatened. That's why self-esteem, the concept of self-esteem, affects so many areas of our life. It affects balance. You know, we know that life is full of balancing. You've got to balance your work, your family, your spirituality, your health, so many things. Why do people struggle with balance? For many reasons, but one of the reasons is because they don't accept themselves. They don't accept their limitations. Because what we need to understand, as we've talked about many times, is that the inferiority complex and the superiority complex is the same complex. You see, when people are not comfortable with themselves, they express it in one of two ways. Either they become the doormat of society, so they really believe that they're nothing. And because they're nothing, which means, therefore, they can never speak up, they can never volunteer information, they can never argue with anyone, they can never have a different opinion. They're always worse. They become the victim and the martyr and the schmata of everyone around them. And of course, that breeds deep unhappiness, and they're never happy, and they're never always kvetching, and it's a miserable sort of life. That's one way to express your inadequacy or your insecurity or your lack of a healthy self-image. But of course, the other way of doing it is to defend it. And never let anyone touch it. So therefore, when you're in a conversation and there's someone who's totally arrogant, they'll never let anyone else talk. Right? I always say that. You know, you have a conversation of people. There's three kinds of people in the room. There's the guy that never says a word. Right? Never says a word. Then there's the person who never lets anyone else talk. Right? Then there's a normal human being who has a conversation, asks and listens and... Right? Who are those two people on the other end? The same type of people. They suffer from the same disease. They suffer from the disease is that they have to defend their very, very fragile and insecure essence. So the one person needs to defend it and says, "Well, I'm not going to volunteer a word because I'm going to look stupid." Right? You ever had that thing where you're in a workshop? And the guy says, "Who would like to volunteer this information?" And like only three people do it. Right? Everyone else is scared. What are they scared of? I've experienced the same thing. I'm not going to volunteer information. I don't need 40 people to look at me like I'm a nut. And what happens if I volunteer information, I make a mistake? And what happens if I say something that sounds really stupid? Does it make me a bad person? Does it make me a stupid person? No, not really. So why don't I do it? Because I'm afraid. And then you're the person that never ever lets anyone take a turn, who right away, boom, has got to volunteer something. Same thing. They suffer from the same problem. None of them have humility. The one has what we call false humility, and the other one has an arrogance, which is obviously not humility. A true humble person is a person that knows themselves, that is comfortable with themselves, doesn't feel superior to anyone else, knows themselves because they understands that what they are is not theirs, what they are is a gift, What they are is a divine imprint, and therefore makes them greater, not smaller, but yet at the same time not superior to other people. And therefore can volunteer information, doesn't have to volunteer information, has room for others, has room for themselves as well. They are part of the equation, they make other people part of the equation, they feel okay with themselves, they accept themselves, they can accept other people. One of the most famous lines in Jewish texts is "Ve'ahavta le'recha kamocha." Love your neighbor as yourself. It's a funny line, no? What do you mean, love your neighbor as yourself? Because, I mean, the simple way of understanding it is a person naturally loves themselves. So, but love themselves, so love someone else like yourself. Or like the same Hillel once said, what you don't like done to you, don't do to others. But yet, it's a strange thing. Why can the Torah just say, "V'ahavta le'recha"? Love other people. Just love them to bits. Love, give a lot of love. But the deeper understanding of it is very simple, because the Torah says, "V'ahavta le'recha," love other people like you love yourself. Because if you don't love yourself, you actually can't love other people. Well, because if you don't have a sense of yourself, then there's no one there to love. Meaning you can't love if you're nothing. If you don't understand yourself, if you don't accept yourself, or on the flip side, if you're so busy and consumed with defending your fragile identity, then there's no room for other people. Yeah, you can display arrogant love, selfish love, as we've talked about in other times. In other words, I can love someone if I have a very poor self-image and I express it in an arrogant way. I can love someone because the person will serve my needs. Which means as soon as they're not serving my needs, I don't love them anymore. That's not love, right? Love means you love the other person, but you love the other person. No one loves the other person. And the same, so the Torah says, "V'ahavta le'recha kamocha," love the other person like you love yourself. If you accept yourself, if you're okay with yourself, if you feel good about yourself, if you're comfortable with yourself, if you have true humility, if you're not obsessed with the ich, because if you're obsessed with the ich, then you don't love yourself. If you're obsessed with the ich, that means you're focused on the I because you're not sure about the I. You're fighting about the I. You're very insecure about the I. You know, they say in the physical sense, right? So what's a sign that something's wrong with part of your body? And you start noticing that part of the body exists, right? You don't walk around the whole day thinking about your foot. It's there. Do you have a mental note that you have a foot? No. It's just part of who you are. Or an arm or a hand. As soon as you know you got a foot, you know something's wrong with it, right? The same thing on the metaphysical level. If someone's completely comfortable with this themselves, they're not focused on the eye. They don't need to be an eye specialist. Because it's fine, it's intact, it's fine, I know who I am, I know my weaknesses, I know my strengths, I know what I have to do. I'm not delusional, I'm not going to tell myself I can do things that I can't do, I'm not going to tell my children they can do, right? This is a very different definition of self-esteem than what Dennis Prager is talking about in the article. This is not falsehood, this is not ego, this is not making people feel good about themselves inappropriately and becoming egocentric and not giving room for other people. That will lead to criminality, right? But that's not self-esteem. A real self-esteem means one that's synonymous with humility, that I'm not focused on myself because I'm okay with myself, because myself is fine, because it's part of a greater reality. That's why I say in Jewish thinking, it's become so much deeper and so much easier, actually. Once we have that perspective, the whole thing is different. One, God is actually part of the equation. It's so much easier to develop this idea. In fact, I'm not sure how it's done without it. But right, because I do have strengths. I do have infinite potential. I do have intrinsic value. But I'm not superior to anyone because it's part of that greater reality, because it has a divine imprint, because it's got an essential purity. That's got to do with, it affects everything. It's got to do with love. It's got to do with respect. Right? We've talked about before that the fundamentals of relationships is to respect another person. You cannot respect another person if you don't respect yourself. But true respect. If I'm okay with myself, then I respect who I am. I have the ability to respect another person. This will affect work relationships. Will affect other relationships. Will affect the way we, our stress levels. It has a lot to do with anger. We'll talk about that. Right? So many things are affected by this concept. So let's go back to our definition. Every person has an intrinsic value. What that means is at the core of every single person There's a spark of the divine imprint. So there's essential goodness that every single person possesses, including ourselves. That's belief number one. Belief number two is that I have a set of competencies. Every person has a contribution to make, but it's not talents necessarily, and it's not things that make me better than other people. It's competencies that God gave me. But God also gave me weaknesses. God also gave me a personality that has rough edges. He also gave me challenges in life. And that's fine. Therefore, it doesn't make me a bad person. It's all part of the godly package. I have to work on them. I have to develop them. And we're going to talk about responsibility in coming weeks. But it doesn't make me a better or a worse person. My strengths and weaknesses don't define me as a better or a worse person. What we need to develop over the next few weeks is to understand that this is a hard thing to do. It's easy to talk about. Wonderful to discuss it in an hour. It's actually a hard thing to really implement and to really believe and to really understand. And what we're going to try and talk about is, first of all, the different areas of life that this affects, and also how do we actually achieve? How do we do this by actually getting to a point where we feel okay with ourselves, we accept ourselves fully? Some of us think we do that, but actually we don't really. And how do we get to that point? How do we use it? How do we learn to use it to nurture our strengths and to take responsibility for our weaknesses and make it work to make us a better human being? Have a wonderful week, and we'll continue next week.